Welcome back to Dark Florida. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland. On today's episode, we're diving deep into the world of Bigfoot and mysteries that surround this legendary cryptid. Joining me is the incredible Maxim Furyk, author of The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. Maxim's latest book explores Bigfoot synchronicity, interdimensional theories, and even Jung's collective unconscious, offering a perspective that challenges everything we think we know about Sasquatch. We'll discuss his thoughts on hoaxes and how Bigfoot connects to science, religion, and the paranormal. If you ever wondered whether Bigfoot is more than just flesh and blood, then this episode is for you. So settle in for another thrilling journey into the unexplained on Dark Florida. I have Maxim joining me. Thank you for coming on tonight. I'm so excited to get to talk to you about your new book and your new event that you have coming up in Florida.
Yeah, thank you, Brooke. Yeah, it's going to be in Beverly Hills, Florida at the Central Ridge Library, and we're looking forward to it. That's going to be January the 28th. And so far, it looks like there's going to be a nice grouping of paranormal and cryptid people there. So it should be a very good time to get together and meet our friends and neighbors and, you know, and see who's out there, because we don't have that many opportunities like this to get together and see who has, you know, like-minded interests. So this is sort of a really interesting thing for the paranormal community. So anyway, that's January the 28th at the Central Ridge Library in Beverly Hills, Florida. That's Citrus County. I'm a former psychologist slash rock journalist, and that's, you know, rock and roll has always been my passion. I love music. I sort of took a look at music through a sociological lens. You know, music's been transformative. It's one of the joys of the world. You know, it was responsible for so many movements, especially for me, a baby boomer. You know, talking about civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, Vietnam, the whole thing. I mean, music, you know, drove you know, those movements and empowered us and gave us that vision. Anyway, I was writing a book about the 1971 song Timothy, and Timothy was a song really big back home in northeastern Pennsylvania. It was about cannibalism in a mine shaft. So I was going to write this song about Timothy the song and its connection to Shepton. And Shepton was a 1963 coal mining disaster that seemed to parallel what happened in the song. And in the real life Shepton, three miners were entombed for 2 weeks, and only two came out. And when the two were rescued, and this was just like a wonderful 2 week international story. I mean, there were reporters there from Germany, Japan, the UK, you know, in northeastern Pennsylvania, thousands of people there watching this thing. And this is huge. And it was a story of human survival. So finally, the two guys come out and the neighbors want to know, what happened to your buddy? What happened to Louis Bova? And immediately there were rumors, you know, about cannibalism, that they ate Louis Bova. And this was back in 63, and it persists until now. I mean, there's still, even Louis Bova's son believes that there's the possibility that his father was cannibalized. And it's just unfounded. It's gory. But I wrote a book about it, and that was 9 years ago. That was 2016, Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music. And that book, 9 years ago, opened up the doors to the paranormal for me. So since then, I've written four other paranormal books, the latest being The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. And but, you know, the Shepton book just opened up the doors. I mean, I was invited to podcast. And yeah, we had podcasts back in 2017, 2018. Not as many as there are now. I mean, it's just like seemed that it's just flourishing. But I was invited to podcasts, to conferences. And the big one was that Australia's Mysterious Universe did a 90-minute profile of the Shepton book and me, which was really amazing to listen to these guys with Australian accents, you know, cherry picking through the book and reading parts of it. It was really kind of cool. But anyway, Shepton was my beginning. That was, and so I've been at this for 9 years, you know, been on a ton of podcasts and invited to expos and everything. And it's great. I mean, the paranormal community has welcomed me and embraced me and accepted me. And I just can't say enough about that. You know, it's just amazing. You know, all of us are looking for connection. We're looking for commonality. We're looking for our tribe. And, you know, I certainly have found mine, which is my good fortune and my good joy.
What makes The Lost Tribe of Bigfoot different from the other books about cryptids? And what inspired you to write this one?
Well, a couple of things. One, if you, and again, I don't mean to, you know, bash my fellows, but, you know, when you pick up some of these other books that are out there, they're very pedestrian. By pedestrian, they're just not well written. They tell the story, but I think to be a good writer, you need to tell the story. You need to be a little bit artsy, a little bit poetic, a little bit stream of consciousness. All of that. You need to go and validate your research with research of other people. So you need to have that whole thing and give it flow and, you know, and make it work, make it fun to read and make it easy to read. I think you need to go and take a difficult topic. And certainly when you talk about cryptozoology or the paranormal, that is a difficult topic because, I mean, what is it? You know, we don't know. We don't have the scientific understanding to explain it. So we're trying to come up with ways to explain something that is almost unknowable. So my book is different because because I believe it's well-researched, well-written. I love the way it looks. And I approach it as a scientist, as an academic, with the premise that if it's not flesh and blood, what is it? And if it's not flesh and blood, I mean, since we don't have a body and we have never come up with legitimate DNA, and for all the DNA that we found, all the hair fibers that we found from the Himalayas to the Pacific Northwest, all of them turned out to be black bear or something else, but we've never come up with a species, an unknown species. I believe that it's the only theory that fits. And I don't think that, you know, I hate some of these researchers that make up new theories to fit this story. You know, there's existing theories there that we need to take a look at and understand before we start fabricating new theories. But Einstein talked about the wormhole or bridge theory. And he claimed that there were bridges from the space-time continuum that would allow entities to travel, you know, from, you know, trillions of light years away, just in a fraction of a second, you know, by bending the space-time continuum. Now, I think that's just a theory. It's never been proven, but it's the best theory that's out there. I believe that Bigfoot and also UFOs are interdimensional, that they shape shift between dimensions, between something like an Einstein wormhole to get from A to B. And that's why we see them and why we don't. You know, we call it rapid transport or bilocation. And, you know, again, you see them in front of you and then they're behind you. So, you know, they're mysterious, they're elusive. So the book was like that. I think it looked at Bigfoot, you know, traditionally, you know, covered a lot of grounds, but also it looked at theories that made sense to me, you know, other than flesh and blood theories. And so far, you know, my approach to the book has been well received. I mean, people that have read it really seem to have liked it.
I see that in your book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, that you go to lengths to call out Bigfoot and UFO hoaxers.
Well, they need to be called out. You know, I mean, what they do is, I mean, they do for themselves. They're just a selfish group of people that are looking for their 15 minutes of fame or their fame and fortune or whatever it is. Or they're trying to con us. Like, I think maybe some of these people are really sharp intellectuals, but they're sort of like, say, Jack the Ripper. They're like the Zodiac Killer. They're like some of these clever psychopaths that just toyed with the authorities. And with Jack the Ripper, he would send letters to Scotland Yard and say, you know, catch me if you can. He would send clues, and so did the Zodiac Killer. So, you know, they were just playing games. You know, I don't know if they wanted to be caught. Maybe they did, but they were just playing games. And so these hoaxers do a lot of things. But the thing that they do that upsets me is that they discredit our element. They discredit the world of the paranormal and cryptozoology by being dishonest. And this is so wrong because we're trying so hard to prove to the world that we are legitimate, that what we're doing isn't just some kind of silly fantasy, and that it does have a scientific basis. And the hoaxers just go and take the wind out of our sails with their lies and their deception. So in The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, I made a note to call them out. I have, I think it's three chapters about the hoaxers, and including the infamous cases of the Piltdown Man hoax and also the Minnesota Iceman hoax, which are just legendary. And if your listeners aren't familiar with those hoaxes, you know, in the world of cryptozoology, they need to go and read my book and read all about it, because it's just, it's important for the, you know, for our profession, you know, to know what's come before us and what, you know, what we still have to deal with.
In your book, you have written that the Piltdown Man had political implications. Why is that?
Well, that's because with the Piltdown Man, you know, the it was discovered in England, and they claimed that there was this creature, a relic of Homo sapiens that was the oldest relic that we found. Now, prior to this, there was the Heidelberg Man that was found in Germany. So this was the oldest man, and there was a competition. It was for nationalistic, it was for national glory and everything that goes with that. But what happened was Charles Dawson, he was an attorney and an amateur fossil collector. He put together some contrived things that he called the Piltdown Man. But what it was actually was, it was an ancient human skull, and it was old, but not as old as he claimed. And then he had the jaw of an orangutan. The teeth were filed down to look more human-like. So he put those together, he peppered them, he doctored them with iron oxide, and he did everything he could to make the bones, the fossils, look old, and also the area where he found them, he did the same thing. So he set this groundwork up, and it took something like 40 years before finally the scientific community called him out and said, no, this is a lie, this is a hoax. But I think some people suspected this, you know, whether they were scientists or politicians, you know, whomever, they were all part of the same thing. But they wanted to have their own fossil, their own original, you know, oldest human being. And so this was just for points. You know, they wanted to score some points over the Germans. And it was all a lie. And they finally got called out. And it was one of the biggest hoaxes in history. And what it did, though, was, I mean, in retrospect, it set back the scientific method, you know, quite a ways. I mean, we could have been spending time moving forward rather than moving backward and putting all of our energies into a contrived hoax. And that's what Dawson and his Piltdown Man did. And there were a lot of people, they believed, that were involved in this thing. So, you know, just a lot of luminaries from back in the day. So it was a pretty, pretty fascinating story, the Piltdown Man. I think that there were a lot of people that wanted to just believe that it was true, and also make other people believe that it was true. There's examples of something like this in history. If you lie about something long enough, you tell the same lie over and over and over again, and if you get enough people to repeat the lie, then it sort of becomes a reality. It's like George Orwell's 1984. And this is scary stuff. And it's has happened during our day, during our times. And this is just frightening when a lie is repeated by a group of people, by a group of organized people who have money and clout. And, you know, it's a scary situation right now, where this is like almost like a new world order for us. So that the mentality behind this Piltdown Man continues today.
Supposedly the JFK files are going to be released, so hopefully we'll get some truth with that situation too, because I feel like that same lie has been repeated for the last 60 years. That'll be very interesting to see what comes of that.
Yeah, and the connection with JFK, and that with my Shepton book, Shepton took place in August of 1963. Shepton was one of the biggest stories of the year, one of the biggest Associated Press stories of the year. The Shepton Mine disaster of 1963. It was surpassed only by the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November of 1963. So that's the tie-in there. And You know, I had a chance to go to Dallas-Fort Worth last year. No, the year before. This is 2023, we were there. And Dealey Plaza, where he was assassinated, there's a thing, the knoll, the grassy knoll. And I went up there, and that grassy knoll is pretty open. I mean, it would be difficult. I think it would be impossible for a shooter to be there. And I don't care if they were hiding behind the thing, but there were thousands of people there watching the parade. I think it was impossible for somebody to be there and get off a shot or shots. So I don't know. I'm just like very skeptical about some of the things that they're saying about this assassination. You know, it's just there's more to it than what we've been led to believe. So I don't know what the truth is. Maybe that will come out.
The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot was recently banned at the 2024 Bloomsburg Fair, which is the largest county fair on the East Coast. What happened?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just think that some people just are a little bit, you know, they're not very flexible. I had a chapter there called Is Bigfoot the New Religion? And I was talking about how organized religion is not as popular as it had been. And what I did, I used some statistics. Now, for example, I'm a baby boomer. We're older. My group was born between 1946 to 1964. And I compared baby boomers with Generation Z. And the oldest one right now is 27 years old. And I compared statistics with baby boomers versus Generation Z. Now, with my group, something like 64% of us believed in God and believed in organized religion, i.e. going to church, 64%. With Generation Z, it's something like 24%. So there's been a huge drop off in belief and attendance. So my question was this, and I put this in my book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, but I think, you know, man is a spiritual creature. Man and woman are spiritual creatures born in the likeness of God. So we're spiritual in nature, and we have a need to express that spirituality. And how do we do this? Well, maybe with my group, we went to church, and that was part of it. But with another group that may not be church goers, how do they do it? And at least for some of them, and this is my contention, they do it by going out there in the woods looking for Bigfoot, which becomes their higher power, having a group of people with shared values. And it becomes like a church, a sacrament, the temple, the higher power, every single element of organized religion that you would want, you know, that hope and optimism of seeing this thing, you know, the awe that it would bring. So I believe that there were some people there that just took offense to that and thought that somehow it was anti-religious or anti-Christian or whatever. And, you know, so anyway, I was disinvited from this thing that I had participated in since its inception. But, you know, I'm not going to back down. I know that, you know, many times whenever I talk about my political views or religious views, you know, there's always pushback, but that's the way it is. That's fine. You know, I still have the right to my opinion, and I'll voice that on podcasts and also through my books. I did want to say my upcoming book is called Paranormal Apocalypse. Is This How It Ends? And we're going to take a look at all this fear and paranoia that seems to surround and embrace the human race. So it's called Paranormal Apocalypse, and I think it's going to be a pretty big hit.
It's really interesting that you draw the parallel between Bigfoot and religion, because I just had this thought the other day. I came back from a trip myself out investigating in Ocala, and I thought Bigfoot is a lot like faith. We're out there, we're in the woods, and we believe this creature that we can't see, don't know where it's at. We believe it's there. And we are just hoping to find that evidence of its existence or get that sighting, catch the glimpse of it. We're so dedicated and so committed. And yes, there are some of us in the community who have had sightings and they've seen it and they emphatically know what they saw. But then you have a whole lot of other people who haven't had that experience, but they're still out there, still dedicated to looking for it. And it really is a lot like faith.
So. Yeah, it is. I think that there's just a lot of power and energy with the Sasquatchers that are going out there, you know, people like you and that Ocala National Forest. I mean, just like a wonderful place to go and do business because, I mean, it's just so much acreage out there. And, you know, that whole Marion County, Lake County, that whole area is just, I mean, that's Bigfoot country. And I live in the Citrus County in Hernando, and we're close to all of that, you know. So, you know, this is the swamp ape territory. In my the presentation I'm going to be doing on the 28th, I have a lot of information that is Florida-based. So we're going to take a look at what Florida brings to the fore as far as the swamp ape and some of the other, the Barden booger and some of these other crazy things that are happening down there. But it's amazing. You know, Florida has a lot of Bigfoot sightings. You know, some believe it's number three after California and Washington State. That's, you know, what the researchers are telling us. So, you know, it's a huge state for sightings. And there's a lot of swamp land here. I mean, the Everglades comprises, what, 16 different counties. I mean, from, you know, Miami-Dade and Naples all the way up to, I think, Polk County. So it's huge. A lot of places for Bigfoot to hide.
What is your fascination with the paranormal? You've kind of switched gears from being a psychologist and rock journalist to now a paranormal author. Why is that?
Well, I think probably the same reason why you do it. You know, it's just, I think there's an Indiana Jones in all of us. You know, there's that spirit of adventure. There's that spirit of finding something. And it's like, you know, it's like being a little kid again, because when you were a kid, you know, your eyes were wide open and you wanted to find out every single thing you could about the universe. I mean, that's what we did as children. We had that childlike glee and awe. And that's why kids learn so fast. You know, they have the synapses going. I mean, they're excited about learning. And if we could maintain, as we do, a lot of us still maintain that excitement, so we keep on learning new things and we want to learn new things. And I think that that's part of the drive. And with the paranormal, I just want to find out what it is. I mean, just like pretty amazing stuff that why is it that so many people are seeing the same thing, whether it's cryptids or whether it's UFOs? I mean, thousands of people seeing similar things. And when you look at the commonality with Bigfoot sightings, you know, the smell, the sound, the knocks, the structures, the fact that those who see Bigfoot, that Bigfoot isn't aggressive, Bigfoot doesn't charge them. And in my tiny little microcosm of the world, the people that I know that have seen Bigfoot, for example, back in, I live in a tiny little place in northeastern Pennsylvania called Maconaqua, and a mountain community. And a friend of mine had seen not one but two Bigfoot creatures as he was leaving a cemetery, and they were on the trail line. And he saw a large black one and a smaller cinnamon one. And I asked him at length, what did they do? How did they act? And they turned around and looked at him, much like the Patterson-Gimlin film, like the Patty looked at Patterson. And then they kept on walking. And he said, they walk like human beings. They did not like bears. They walk like human beings. So they walked away. And then I went there later for a couple of days looking for tracks, looking for whatever, and went back there, but I couldn't see anything. Another story, this is back home, guy that was a sheriff, he got a phone call from an older man about 11 o'clock at night. The guy was letting his dog out to take a leak, and he saw this creature about 12 foot tall, and he wasn't afraid. He said that this creature had kind eyes. It had kind eyes. And so that's, you know, two stories there. My neighbor wasn't crazy. He was just in awe. This guy was in awe. Back home, Bill Rigby, who has Agents of the Unexplained, and I'm going to be on his program this week, but Bill saw a Bigfoot at 15 foot, and he said it left him traumatized. He suffers from PTSD from that. There's different variations, you know, with these sightings. I mean, it's not the same for everybody. And I do want to say my alleged Bigfoot sighting, I just want to talk about this because I think it's important. But last year, my wife and I were walking down by the woods in Pennsylvania by the Susquehanna River. And there's a trail that goes next to the river, and sometimes it's flooded out and you can't go there. So this time it was dry. So we thought we'd check it out and see what's down there. And we're walking, and up ahead of me, there was this dark shape. And I'm always looking for Bigfoot, always. And I thought, wow, maybe this is it. You know, it's coming towards me, huge shoulders. It ducks behind the tree and it's coming towards me. And this took all a matter of like 1,001, 1,002, 1,003 seconds. For those 3 seconds, I thought I saw a Sasquatch. And then this thing comes towards me. And here it was, a woman wearing a dark coat, almost like a fur coat with the lapels, you know, the shoulder pads, and made her look very Bigfoot-like. And it wasn't Bigfoot. But again, for those 3 seconds, I thought it was. And I mean, for me, that rush of adrenaline, that feeling that, man, I mean, I had it for those 3 seconds. You know, it wasn't the real thing, but it was. But I thought it was. And, you know, if it's all about perception for those 3 seconds, you know, I experienced a little bit of what, you know, some of these witnesses see. So again, I'm not, you know, comparing myself in any way to, you know, to the honor, you know, the privilege that they've had of seeing something, but it was kind of close, or it may be the closest that I'll ever get, but I'll never forget that. It was just a really, you know, just an amazing thing that I experienced. And so, you know, call it what you will, but, you know, it was profound, and I can still remember it and see it and feel it. Amazing stuff.
Earlier, you said that there was a bit of a connection between Bigfoot and the UFO and the paranormal. What have you come across in your research that has really solidified that idea for you that they're connected?
Well, I think that, you know, you have witnesses, you have the proof, you have actually 2 bodies of proof that I think we hold on to, people like you and I, for example, in the world of Bigfoot. But the Patterson-Gimlin film of 1967 seems to be our holy grail. It's never been disproven, but it's been validated by a whole lot of people like Dr. Jeff Aldrum from the University of Idaho and Lauren Coleman and just like a number of the, you know, the four horsemen of Sasquatchery. So we think that it's the real thing, that it's, you know, it's only a 58-second video. People that look at it, they look at the gait, look at the stride. You know, no man, no bear could make that kind of a stride. They looked at the footprints, you know, larger than any man or bear. So there's just a whole lot of things that make sense. Not a man in a costume. There's no zippers or lining or anything else. It's, you know, skin tight. You could see the buttocks and you could see the, you know, the other muscles and that. They've had people walk like Patty to try to emulate that, and they just can't get the stride, the gait, any of that. So I believe, and a lot of people believe that the Patterson-Gimlin film is authentic. I had a chance to be interviewed with Tom Cantrell, who wrote the book 29 Days to Destiny. And Tom Cantrell knew Bob Gimlin, and he really put a lot of effort into this book, into taking a look at the Patterson-Gimlin film. So, you know, I'm going to be on another podcast with him. So the other one, the opposite then with Flying Saucers is the 2004 Tic Tac video that Navy pilots took off of the coast of San Diego. And here was this craft that hovered back and forth faster, you know, with a G-force that human beings couldn't withstand. And then it hovered and then it went down under the water. So the Pentagon that was calling UFOs, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, then changed that tag to, after it went underwater, to unidentified anomalous phenomenon, because these things seem to be in the air and also in the water. So that, those two videos seem to be the proof that we have on either side, but also the fact that they seem to be shapeshifters, and I think they both may be interdimensional, and not extraterrestrial but interdimensional. That extraterrestrial hypothesis, I think, is just passé, doesn't make sense. It's going to take too long, too much energy, too much anything. I don't think anybody got the wherewithal to do that, to go trillions of miles, you know, on a gas tank, on a, you know, on any kind of a craft. So I think that the interdimensional theory works for not only Bigfoot, but for flying saucers. And I love to use the word flying saucers and UFOs. I mean, they just that just stays with me than UAP. So,
so it's a classic.
Yeah, I know. Let the Pentagon sue me or whatever. So, but there's just a whole lot of things like that. So I just think that the current issue of Fate magazine, I have an article on Chestnut Ridge. And Chestnut Ridge is that area in where Pam Esper is from, our friend, our mutual friend. And in western Pennsylvania, there's an area called Chestnut Ridge, four counties. And actually, it's more than four counties, but these counties where they see an abundance of Bigfoot sightings connected with UFO sightings and or orbs. So again, the fact that it's not just Bigfoot, but it's orbs and saucers lends many of us to believe that there's a paranormal element to this. Whatever that is, we don't know. But I mean, just seeing an orb appear and Bigfoot creatures come out of it, or the Bigfoot creatures leave and an orb appears and they leave. So too many stories like that. And, you know, again, I can't explain it, but that's we have plenty of Bigfoot researchers in western Pennsylvania that document this stuff and they catalog it. And we're, you know, I think we're unique in western Pennsylvania that we have people that do that. People like Eric Altman, Stan Gordon, you know, Bill Rigby, just a whole lot of people that are, you know, keeping score, keeping documenting these things. So, you know, we have a lot of information there that, you know, I think it is good data.
I would be remiss if, while we're on the topic of orbs, UAPs, UFOs, if I didn't ask your opinion, have you seen some of the footage that's come out of New Jersey with the alleged drones and some of the drones that look more like plasma than they do your typical drone?
Yeah, I follow that. The drone hysteria of 2024, I think it was around Thanksgiving of 2024, and all of a sudden everybody's looking up in the sky. But the thing that that got me, that I talked about more than anything else, was the element of fear. And, you know, any government needs to keep us feel safe and protected. And during this drone hysteria, and I want to get political here for a second, because everybody screwed up. The Biden administration didn't have anybody that was able to competently articulate what was up there, what we were seeing. And I was just really as frustrated as the next person that, you know, there was no explanation. And then president-elect at the time, Donald Trump, instead of keeping his mouth shut and letting this thing play out, he said that the administration knew something but was not sharing this with the public. So immediately people are thinking there's a conspiracy to withhold information. So that just fanned the flames of conspiracy and anxiety and everything else. And it was like everybody piling on. You had Biden administration, you had Trump, you had the Republican senator from South Carolina who said they could be extraterrestrial. You had another person that said that it's possible that somebody, well, that said that a terrorist stole a nuclear weapon from Ukraine and transported it to New Jersey, and government drones were scouring New Jersey looking for that heat signature to track down that radioactive bomb. And so anyway, the stories just got more and more and more. It was almost like 1938 with Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, where there are a lot of people getting hysterical and, you know, supposedly committing suicide. But the drone hysteria of 2024 was a good example of us getting scared. And it was a good example of that Rorschach test, where you look up in the sky. And before, none of us were looking up in the sky, but I mean, we started to look up at the sky. And I'll tell you what, if you keep on looking up in the sky, you're going to see something. But what we saw, it wasn't flying saucers from another planet. What the fear was, we were afraid that these were drones from either Russia or China or Iran. So that was the big fear. Same thing back in 1938. You know, even though War of the Worlds was about Martians coming, landing in New Jersey, but people weren't afraid of Martians. They were afraid that this was some sort of an invasion from Germany or, you know, another foreign entity. So, you know, the first go-to is World War II, not, war with the Martians. So that was a pretty interesting thing. And then the drone hysteria of 2024 is gone. It's nobody talks about it anymore. You know, it's just like it's come and gone. It was just like the Chinese balloon thing the year before in 2023. You know, we had that and we shot some down. So, you know, I don't know. The world's crazy, and we try to make sense of it. And the only answer to the drone hysteria, that chapter of 2024, is that we all got scared and we all got frustrated, and we had a hard time handling that correctly.
It left just as quickly as it came, and it kind of felt like you were saying about the fear and anxiety, like an energy harvesting ritual or some kind of distraction or all of the above or something else entirely. It definitely... It was a weird few weeks for sure.
I ask you this: if it was a distraction, if this was a way to distract us from something, what was that something that we were being kept from? What do you think that was?
I think it could have been a test, a reactionary test, to see if you take a group of people and you expose them to something, what is their reaction going to be if we let these drones out in the middle of an American suburbia? What is the people's reaction? What are they going to do? And maybe just kind of test the waters. That's what I wonder. That's a great point. Distraction from what? A good magician always has you looking over here while they're really performing a trick over there. Lots of what ifs.
Yeah, I thought about this. I don't know what that the distraction could have been, but you know, but it's one of those things, or just a way to manipulate us and see how far can we manipulate the people and what does it take? And, you know, it just takes some well-placed media spots to get and podcasts to get people talking. And that's what they did.
On the topic of UFOs, have you ever investigated any kind of abduction stories?
No, the closest I came were, a friend of mine seems to be followed by orbs, and she has all kinds of stories about that, but she believes that she's being stalked by the orbs and that they're a living entity, and she just has story upon story. So most people that come up to me and tell me something of the paranormal, they tend to be about either orbs, A, or B, talking to dead people. And these are people that have passed that they're having conversations with. And, you know, so two things. I mean, nothing earth shattering, nothing that you haven't heard before. But these are very commonplace in my world. I mean, I hear it all the time. It doesn't surprise me when somebody comes up to me and tells me about the orbs that they've seen. So, you know,
right.
I think some people have a gift. I think they have some kind of altered state of perception, where they're attuned to some of these things, whether it's seeing a Bigfoot or seeing orbs or angels or whatever. I think a lot of these things are out there, but they're only visible to some of us. But again, I think that, you know, whether they're angels, orbs, whatever, you know, cryptids, they're out there. They can be seen, but only by a select few. So, you know, I know a guy that he claims his family members have this gift, and they all see, you know, certain things. So I don't know. And I think that's a gift. I think that's a really special gift. And even maybe even a sacred gift, you know. I don't think people should capitalize on it. But anyway, you know, it's your choice. It's your life. So to do with that. But I've never been in that situation, you know, to make that call. So.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I heard an interview of a psychic, and you get the same thing. You hear the same stories. Well, why don't you play the lotto? And her response was, we don't get to do it for ourselves. It doesn't work that way. They don't get to use their gift for personal gain. They're using it to help other people connect with, say, like you said, past relatives or find clarity on things. She's like, it doesn't work like that. It's not about what we can do for ourselves.
And Alcoholics Anonymous, that has, I used to be a drug and alcohol counselor, and one of the best things I did was I co-facilitated AA meetings with Ed H., which was just awesome, just an awesome thing. But in AA, they say, you can't keep it unless you give it away. So whatever gifts you get, you know, you need to go and share it with somebody else. You keep on giving it away, you pass it on. Beautiful concept. I mean, AA, I'll tell you what, I'm a better person for having been able to be a part of AA and to learn as much as I have from Ed H., who is just a wonderful, wonderful friend and guru. And so just an amazing thing. So you can't keep it unless you give it away.
I see you're with Hangar One Publishing, and they use an innovation called immersive book technology, which uses QR codes. What exactly is that? Is the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot part of this technology?
Yeah, we were one of the first ones. You know, Doug and Alex Highcheck, they're the CEOs behind Hangar One, but they use this thing, and I don't think it's brand new technology, but they've taken technology and reinvented it. So throughout my book, there's QR codes, and you would take your camera, the camera from your phone, and just hit that QR code, press a little button there, and that would open up a video of me doing, say, a 3-minute synopsis of that chapter. So these QR codes are throughout the book, but they're really innovative. It makes it more interactive and gives another dimension to the to the book. We shot these up in my office and back in Pennsylvania, which was turned out really cool. You know, we had the perfect lighting and everything. And I was able to actually be articulate for these. So that worked out. But yeah, it's called IBT, Immersive Book Technology. And I'm just really excited that, you know, that The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, you know, was one of the initial books to have that technology. And I can just imagine, I think that in the future, a lot of books are going to go that same way. It's just the future is here, you know. It's just going to happen. First of all, I would hope that if anybody's within shouting distance, you know, to Citrus County, that they would think about coming down to Beverly Hills on Tuesday, January the 28th at 1 o'clock. It's going to be from 1 to, say, 2:30. And there should be a number of people there from the paranormal and cryptid demographic. So it's going to be fun just to meet some like-minded people. So I'll be doing a presentation. It's free. I'll have some of my books there if anybody's interested in autographed copies. But so that's January 28th in Beverly Hills, Florida. The other thing is you could contact me on my website, which is www.maximfuric.com, and contact me, and I'd be glad to go and hook you up with a autographed copy of a book or two. Or if you want to go through Amazon, you could contact Amazon or Hangar One Publishers and check out my books there. So the books include the Shepton Mythology, also Coal Region Hoodoo, and the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. So they're all, you know, pretty neat books with great research and, I believe, writing. Check it out. See what you think. If anybody gets any copies, please be free. Consider putting a review on Amazon. That makes such a difference for us authors, you know, when we get those reviews. So if you could.
Will you be in attendance at the Great Florida Bigfoot Conference this year?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, we're going to have a booth there at the Ocala Bigfoot Expo, and I'm looking forward to meeting the folks. And you know, we've been getting a lot of exposure for the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, so I think we're going to do well. And I know there's been a lot of interest, you know, in the book, so I can't wait to be down there and seeing some of my friends again, like Pam Esper and her group. So yeah, it should be fun.
Absolutely, I'll have to stop by. I will be in attendance.
Yeah, please do, Brooke. I'd love to meet you in person, and We'll get our picture together and we'll put it on Facebook. How's that sound?
All right. That sounds good. And I'll have you sign my copy of the book.
Sounds good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me on Dark Florida. And I want to thank your viewers for hanging in there and listening. And I hope that, it was interesting and beneficial. It was a great time. So thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Dark Florida. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Maxim Furyk as much as I did. His book, The Lost Tribe of Bigfoot, is a must-read for anyone fascinated by cryptids and the mysteries of our world. Be sure to check it out and let him know what you think. And if you're in the area, don't miss Maxim's event on January 28th at the Beverly Hills Central Ridge Library from 1 to 2:30 p.m., where he'll be discussing his new book in person. It's a fantastic opportunity to hear more about his unique perspectives and insights into the world of Bigfoot. And don't forget to connect with Dark Florida. You can follow us on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast and support the show by buymeacoffee.com/Dark Florida. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/Dark Florida 411. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show, send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more spooky, strange, and thrilling stories from the Sunshine State and beyond. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.